Hello and welcome, but not to the Planet Money podcast. No, today we are bringing you the Planet Money Deep Read podcast. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. And this is this new thing that we're trying. It's an extra podcast in addition to our regularly scheduled Tuesday and Friday podcasts. And we're testing it out for the first time today.
So the basic idea is we get all these books and we talk to these big thinkers who have these big broad ideas about how the world works. And we often have a lot of fun having these big, long, broad-ranging conversations with these folks. And we thought, you guys probably would like to listen in every once in a while.
So today we are bringing you the first one. Think of it as a Planet Money bonus extra that we're going to try out from time to time.
This is a conversation I had with Ian Bremmer. He's a podcast regular, the president of Eurasia Group, a consulting group that advises businesses on how to deal with the economic implications of world politics.
He's the guy you would call if you were, say, the president of Coke and there was a coup in Thailand.
Exactly. He's got a brand new book with a provocative title, The End of the Free Market: Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations?
So who does win?
All right. I'm going to say this for the first time in my life. Stay tuned to find out. Let's start quickly. Let's lay out what is the big idea in this book, and then we'll dig a little deeper. But you're saying it's the end of the free market, so we're clearly going back to communism or feudalism or mercantilism. Explain to me what your argument is.
I'm saying that there used to be a global, an increasingly global free market over the last 40 years. Multinational corporations were becoming increasingly powerful as economic actors with access to increasingly global capital markets, consumer markets, and labor markets. And we've hit a tipping point in the last 18 months as a consequence of this massive global economic contraction. The Western developed states with free market economies, some more regulated, some very unregulated, are on their heels now. And the fastest economy coming out of the recession, world's second largest now and fastest growing, is China. And it's not a free market system. It's actually a state capitalist system, a system where the state is the principal actor and arbiter in the economy and uses the markets for ultimately political purposes.
And not just China, as you make clear in the book, but many, many countries around the world in throughout the world, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, Eastern
sure.
Europe.
Russia, many countries in the Middle East, most all of the Persian Gulf, a lot of commodities producers around the world. There are a lot of state capitalist countries out there. And so what we have are these states that are actually using the tools of the markets, but they're using them to support their own domestic players, their own national champions. Some of them are state-owned, some of them aren't. The issue here is that you have both the state as the principal actor in the economy, but also no rule of law. And so as a consequence, you are willing to accept all sorts of foreign direct investment as you need capital. And you're willing to accept all sorts of technology as you need the innovation. But if you don't need it anymore, and if your guys can produce it themselves, you'll do it yourself. And that hybrid proves strong.
You say no rule of law. Now, I think in one way in my mind, I think, well, when the government's doing something, that is the rule of law. But what you mean is the government of China, the government of Saudi Arabia, the government of Venezuela can act more arbitrarily to pursue their own self-interest than, say, the government of the U.S. can. That if suddenly President Obama decided everyone should buy Fords instead of Toyotas, he can use the bully pulpit. There are levers he can pull, but there are laws that he has to follow.
Let's imagine that President Obama wanted to rip up $165 million of contracts, bonuses to AIG workers that everyone in the country hated.
Which
he thought about.
Yeah.
And then he realized 3 days later it was a bad idea. And the reason he realized it was a bad idea is we were going to get lawyered up for years in this country. Because even if it's something you really don't like, there are laws. There are contracts. You don't just get nationalized. You have the right to go and defend yourself. But the point is that in a state capitalist country, right, the state arbitrarily decides what the rules of the game are going to be. And they don't really tell you, right? I mean, if you think about it, I have this analogy. I talk about a football field, a football pitch, where in a free market economy that's properly regulated, you have a referee on the field who is ensuring that the rules are followed. And you get penalized if you don't follow them. Now, in the last 10 years, the ref wasn't paying attention to the game in a lot of countries. But that's the way it works, right? In a state capitalist country, you have a ref who tells one of the teams what the rules are. And that team is made up of your friends and family, right? And so if you're a member of the other team, you're probably not going to do very well in those games that the ref wants his buddies to win.
Well, I think this is exactly what I want to get into. So first off, I just want to explain, when you say tools of the market without being free market, I guess the primary tool of the market is the price system, the price signal as a way of allocating resources. And when capitalist economists critique communism, they say, well, they didn't have the price system, you know, supply and demand, a price signal that when oranges start costing more, that's a signal that it's that they are rarer or there's more demand for them. So there should be some effort made to increase the supply. And it all happens very chaotically. There's no central governor saying, all right, oranges should now be 30 cents. And when you do have a central planning authority like the Soviet Union did, the general conclusion is, it seems true, is that any one small group of people cannot know enough information to actually allocate resources correctly. So in the U.S., which is not, as you point out frequently in the book, is not truly a free market economy. It's a managed economy, but probably less managed than many other economies. In the U.S., generally, the government doesn't really take a view on how resources are allocated in many cases. But China will take a view on a whole bunch of issues. And so state capitalism is a system where the price signal is allowed to work in most cases, but there is a central power that tips the scale that has a that can exert arbitrary and huge power when they want things to go a way that the market, that the price signal would not send them on their own.
Yes, can and will, for ultimately political purposes, to ensure their own sustainability. State capitalism is not a global ideology. It's not meant to maximize economic profits. It's statist. It is meant to keep states in power. Globalization, aspects of globalization were a direct challenge and affront to them. And state capitalism is their direct response. And the problem is that ultimately state capitalism and free market capitalism are incompatible economic systems.
So, all right. So let's go to China, because it seems to me that right now, China, you just said state capitalism and market capitalism are incompatible. It seems like China's a huge argument against that point, that China's doing really, really well on both metrics. They're growing much faster than the U.S., than the West. They're more stable. They're, you know, they were buffeted less by this global crisis than we were. And they're as powerful as ever, it seems, the Chinese Communist Party.
They are. The massive thing that has changed, the game-changing element of world politics and world economics, is that the Chinese government has recognized, and there's a consensus in Beijing on this, that they can no longer ensure their economic growth and therefore their political stability because of what's happened in the last 18 months. The Chinese recognize that they're not going to be able to export as much stuff to the West because the West can't buy the way they used to and they won't be able to. So as a consequence, you have a system where the Chinese suddenly are supporting massive indigenous innovation. They have to maintain their stability. They're pumping up their own companies, both state-owned and privately owned, because you know those they're becoming now very competitive internationally. And we're going to see, as I suggest in the book, a war between states and corporations. And in places where that war can't be averted, the corporations will lose. And this happened first, of course, publicly with Google, which was not a human rights issue ultimately, and it wasn't a freedom of speech issue. It was that the Chinese government preferred a private company, but a Chinese private company, Baidu. And so as a consequence, we were Googled out. And this is happening to hundreds of American and Western Japanese-European corporations investing in China right now. They just don't want to say it publicly because they have a lot to lose. But they're all saying it privately, and not just us. I mean, they're saying it to the American government. They're saying it anonymously to the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce. This is a game changer, and we are only starting to understand this. This is – we're all right now focused on The Big Short and Goldman Sachs and the last 18 months, and let's beat up on banks, and it feels really good to do that, but we are – absolutely not yet paying any attention to the fact that the world around us has changed more dramatically in the last 18 months than at any point since World War II.
Wow. And so here's what my economic training teaches me about where China is right now. That they are facing an unbelievably perilous moment. So where China has been up till what you've just described, this transition you've just described, is catching up, copying from us. There's, you know, as our reporting on Haiti tells us, as, you know, any very poor country you see, there's, if you're much less productive, much farther behind technologically than the West, there are, it's not that hard to grow very quickly once you get a few things right, because there's just, I mean, just in agricultural alone, there's so many innovations. If you take a typical Chinese peasant who was operating basically in a medieval technological world and you bring them up to the 19th century or even the 18th century, they're going to be a lot more productive. You can sort of have, you know, turnkey businesses where you just get some Westerner to build you a TV factory or whatever, and you can instantly employ a lot of people, make some money. And that copying process, in my mind, is very compatible with state capitalism. It might be more compatible. But the theory anyway, and I guess now we're going to actually find out, but the economic theory is the next step, indigenous growth, indigenous innovation, actually Chinese companies coming up with new ideas, it requires that is incompatible with state control, because if you don't have intellectual property protection, then you don't have an incentive for people to create new ideas. You have an incentive for people to copy other people's ideas. If you don't allow the market itself to allocate bank loans, if the government's allocating bank loans, then it's not going to be the best, most productive businesses that get loans. It's going to be the cousin of the governor or whatever who gets the loans. And so my economic training leads me to predict that maybe China switching to we're going to do this ourselves, that's going to be a rough time for China. It's not going to work.
I suspect you're right. Certainly that is my belief as well, on the basis of, you know, all of the limited historical data and the theoretical training that I have. But I also say to people that tell me, well, you know, China's going to be like Japan and it's going to have a lost decade or two lost decades or what have you, this is not a near-term bubble. We've never seen – there's no question the Chinese system is less efficient, particularly when it comes to the decisions of how to effectively allocate capital and how to stimulate your own indigenous innovation. It's going to be very hard for them to build and try to become a developed country. But when you have 1.3 billion people, when you have such extraordinary greenfield sites, I mean 60% of all of the new nuclear plants in the world that are presently being developed or have been approved are in China. The building there is just extraordinary. The relative productivity that they can continue to bring online with new labor is something unlike the world has ever seen before. And so I can agree with you. Okay, China's a bubble. Okay, they're not going to have sustainability in their environment in 20 years' time. Okay, they're not going to have sustainability of their labor demographics in 20 years' time. But I also look at the last 2 years and I recognize that today the average Chinese is better disposed towards their own government than the average American or Japanese or Greek or German are to their governments. The last 18 months have given these guys a much longer lease on life. And it wasn't even close to falling apart before the economic crisis. So I sit here saying, you know what, I feel very, very comfortable that at least looking out 5 years, maybe even 10, that we're not going to see China collapse, that the problems that you are suggesting that I think you're right about are they're not going to hit China tomorrow.
They're 2030's problem.
They may be – they're at least 2020, 2025. And you know what? I don't know many people out there that are really planning for 2025. I know people that are saying what's going to happen in the next year, 2 years, 5 years. And in the next 1, 2, 5 years, the problem of the end of the free market – and the coming war between states and corporations becomes vastly more acute.
So explain this war between corporations and states. Obviously, if we were writing a movie in the 1970s, we'd be talking about an actual war between corporations and states, effectively, or cities anyway. Is that what you're talking about? You know, Halliburton up against the People's Revolutionary
Army?
Well,
you see that on my cover, I actually have tanks, and some of the tanks have skyscrapers on them, and some of them have government capitals on them. And you know, I thought that was sufficiently evocative. Well, I'm not talking about conventional wars, of course, but I have to tell you that when you have hundreds of Western multinational corporations that have seen industrial espionage that's been directly targeted at them through cyber attacks, massive unprecedented cyber attacks that either were directly organized by the Chinese government or were known about and actively tolerated by the Chinese government on behalf of Chinese corporations, that's a pretty good description of a war. I mean, national security is no longer about tanks. National security is increasingly about economic well-being. And internet security and issues that allow us to live on day-to-day basis. We're not worried today about the Soviets blowing us up with nukes, but we are worried that our kids are going to be able to enjoy a quality of life that is vaguely related to our own. And I see this as absolutely being a fundamentally conflictual relationship that is coming out between these corporations that are increasingly going to have to fight against other entities, economic entities that are being supported by governments where there isn't rule of law.
So I want to sort of wrap things up. And with what does this mean for the average person? What does it mean for me who doesn't run a multinational corporation? And my sense is it just means this is just a lousier world, right? I mean, it's a world where everything we know about economics tells us there's going to be less economic growth in general. If China doesn't grow as much as we'd like it to, then we don't sell products. And if we're not allowed to sell products to them, then we don't sell products to them. So we don't then grow. We don't get the advantage of China having a more consumer-led economic growth. If you have more failed states around the world or just economic basket cases around the world, that's just bad for us, right?
Certainly in this world, with globalization increasingly challenged by state capitalism, market size globally and market access globally decreases. And that means less global economic growth, no question. Hand in hand with that is a world where you see less coordinated governance. And on issues that are increasingly global that require coordinated responses like climate change and like nuclear proliferation and like trade and financial regulations and the like, you will not see global responses. You'll see Copenhagen. And that means that you're also going to see less efficiency and more spikes as bigger events that hit as a consequence the global markets are things we have to deal with. So the next 10 years, we are in for a rougher ride. And not just we Americans, though clearly in it, from a trajectory perspective, we can say we Americans. This is a global issue.
Great. All right. I think that's a sufficiently depressing place to end. So thank you so much, Ian Bremmer. The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations.
Adam, my pleasure.
That was a fascinating conversation, Adam.
Thank you, Alex. We want to ask our listeners, send us notes at planetmoney@npr.org. Let us know, do you like the idea of having a deep read? Are there books and authors that you're particularly excited about? We're not sure how often we're going to do it, but we'd love to hear if this is something that you enjoy. Meanwhile, I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Blumberg. Thanks for listening to the Planet Money Deep Read.
The regular Planet Money podcast will come back on Friday.